Thanks for continuing on with us. I'm taking over from Nina Rosman, and we continue our coverage on the movement of the ringgit. As of this morning, the ringgit is at 4.55 against one US dollar. This comes on the back of some of the remarks made by the Prime Minister, also the Minister of Finance yesterday in the Parliament, saying that Malaysia's economy is well under control, inflation is under control, and that growth is expected to be quite robust for this year. Here to unpack this and more is Han Liu of Ringgit Plus joining us. Han, what do you make of these movements right now, particularly on the severe weakening of the ringgit over the past few weeks?
Morning, Ibrahim. Morning, everyone. I think, just a bit of context, the ringgit, had a huge strengthening run from kind of last November to January. We went all the way down to 4.25 to US dollar at the end of January and has since deteriorated over the last 3-4 months by about 8% to 4.55, as you mentioned. I think the story is not so much domestically. Domestically, the numbers, I don't want to say look good, but I say they look much more improved from previous years. Like, inflation was super high last year. This year it's moderated and it's going to be further moderated by end of the year to under 3%. So it's getting close to the 2% target. Economic growth is not blockbuster like last year's recovery year, but still moderating, right, to that 5%, which is what we were doing pre-COVID. So I think it's not a case, I guess, of too much domestic issues that are causing pressure to the ringgit right now, but more so about what's happening with the global economy, right? Namely, what's happening with oil, what's happening with the US dollar and rates, and what's happening with, China, and the US in terms of their demand and how we're exporting to them. So I think there's a huge confluence of factors, not necessarily heavily domestic.
And of course, because of these factors outside our control, what would be some of the outlook when it comes to the ringgit movement? Do you feel that the ringgit will continue to weaken even further, considering that these external factors are not going to abate anytime soon?
Yeah, I think as a licensed financial planner, advisor, and I look after a lot of people's investments now, I tell people to look at a couple of key things other than the domestic front for Malaysia, right? How do I, what do I need to look at to kind of get a sense of where the ringgit is heading or where we're heading, right? And the number one thing, I guess, to look at is the price of oil, right? Brent specifically, it's down from this time last year, it's in $120 a barrel, now it's $75. Malaysia is a huge, beneficiary of higher oil prices in terms of our export of those items. Now that, oil is down, 35% year on year, that's going to impact us, the amount of oil that we export as a country. We're a heavily exporting country for that. And, I don't need to go too much about Petronas. So that's one thing to look for. It's now down at 75 barrel. That's way down from last year. So any further weakening in global demand impacting the price of oil will definitely have second order effects on the ringgit. Second thing I tell investors to look at is how is the health of the global economy when it comes to our exports, right? So how do you look at that? Using Malaysia's exports as a barometer, and you can see the April numbers came out last week. Exports are down to China 20% down versus last year. Exports to the US also about 20% down. So you can see, hey, we had a great export year last year. It's starting to look like it's, I don't want to say running out of steam, but starting to slow down. And as the export, the less we're able to kind of defend our currency with exported money, right? Sorry, exported goods getting things like US dollars, yen, and euros into the country, right, to defend the ringgit. So I think that's kind of a few things to look at, right, in terms of forecasting or looking at in terms of the ringgit.
Okay, I have to ask this question, though I don't believe it myself. Political risk is something that we need to debate on, at least in the next few minutes. If I can just insert this particular graphic that my colleague has just presented a few minutes ago, Nina. We can just end this graphic right now. Yep, there you go. Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim assumed the Prime Ministerial office on the 24th of November. And as you can see, from 23rd November onwards, the ringgit strengthened quite considerably to a point of, say, 4.2, 4.25, something like that. And then, of course, it's weakening again. Does the weakening or the strengthening of the ringgit have anything to do with amending date on how this administration is running its affairs? Is this a referendum of sorts in terms of Anwar Ibrahim's capability in leading this government?
I don't have a specific political viewpoint, but what I can share is that markets and investors hate uncertainty. And you can see, you know, about a year ago, growing uncertainty about the political stability of a country impacting the ringgit, alongside, obviously, all the factors from last year around the US dollar's tightening cycle, right? Heading up to November. During November, you know, there was a one-time, you know, elimination of, as it were, of the uncertainty around what's happening with Malaysia politically. We had an election. We had an unclear result from a political standpoint, but from a fiscal governmental standpoint, it was fairly clear, right? There was a government to be formed rather than no government. That would have been disastrous. And that gave investors confidence that, hey, there is a government. It's going to, election was held. There is a government, so, you know, let's get back to business, essentially. And now I think there's a bit of challenge for, you know, the government we have today. It's not so much around a referendum, the ringgit being a referendum, right? We have headwinds globally, right? And the performance of ringgit is largely, I would say, 2/3 to 80% driven by those global factors. The remaining, yes, I think, the Prime Minister and the government have a lot on their hands to deal with, I don't say defend the ringgit, but to ensure that, we keep the market confident in our country, right? We keep the market confident in the political stability of our country without kind of delaying the state elections too much, without worrying too much kind of stuff. I just get it done, right? And continue governing, continue sound policies, which, you know, can allow us to respond somewhat to those global factors, right? Without that, that's going to cause further pressure on the ringgit.
Let's talk a little bit more about the global factors then, because the markets currently are awaiting the minutes of the latest FOMC meeting that is due tomorrow. Markets are pricing in a 68.68% chance of rates being held steady next month and another 31.4% chance that a 25 basis point hike is going to take place. This is, of course, a CME Fed Watch tool has shown. Because of this, do you feel that the upcoming US Federal Reserve interest rate is going to impact further the movement of the ringgit and to a large extent, the way investments are going to be attracted for domestic purposes right now?
A good question. I think, all eyes on that, right, in terms of what's the posturing, right, whether they are going to further raise, where they're going to stop here. And even if they do stop here, one thing that investors need to note is how long do they stop for? Because rates are at a kind of 15-year high. In financial crisis, in the 2008 financial crisis, right? They're, you know, well over 5% now in terms of the Fed funds rate. And you look at that kind of it going the next month or so. I think the more important thing also to look at is not so much the FOMC, but, you know, politically, are the US going to solve this debt ceiling issue? If they don't, then that's going to be a big, big amount of volatility in the market, a lot of risk off the table. And, you know, risk off the table means emerging markets suffer because we're seen as higher risk, higher return countries. So risk off means, you know, we're going to suffer in terms of foreign fund outflows because there's going to be a flight to safety somewhere. It may not be.
Yeah, sorry, we kind of lost you a bit in patches there. Let's look at the role of domestic investors here in Malaysia. ETFs seem to be hot right now when it comes to trying to find investment, when it comes to investing or growing your investment. We're looking at, because of the US dollar being so high against the ringgit, now would be a good time to start looking at investments internationally, at least for retail investors, folks like me, like you. Do you think that this kind of thinking is the right way of thinking, or is there more nuance to this kind of line of argument right now?
A great line of argument, I think. All investors should look to diversify. And most people, when they say diversify, they think, okay, buy more than one stock or buy stocks plus bonds. But when I say diversify, I also mean across countries and currencies, right? If you don't do that, you're leaving yourself at risk to a specific country. Now, we live in Malaysia, so it's probably more than okay. We have a lot of allocation to Malaysia, but diversification means you got to look elsewhere. Global stocks, US stocks, global bonds, US bonds, international bonds, right? Just to diversify your own portfolio and not necessarily as a trigger because, you know, where the ringgit specifically going. It's more around making sure you have more exposure. So the nuance is, yes, you should be looking overseas for a part of a portfolio, but probably not do it only as a result of, you know, seeing where the ringgit is going, whether it's up or down. I think it should just be always a part of your portfolio anyway, and don't worry too much about it in the investment perspective.
Very recently, yesterday, the Prime Minister made a few announcements in the Parliament, including that on the 1MDB solution, for instance. He's talking about how Malaysia is going to discuss findings with the 1MDB solutions with Abu Dhabi. He also mentioned that there would be no more subsidies for T20, including that of no electricity tariff hike except for T20 households. So, we're looking at the government actively trying to see how they can manage the subsidy bill for the government, at least for the budget 2024 that's going to be expected to be presented in just a few months from now. Because of this, do you feel that there would be market jitters in terms of how investors are going to look at Malaysia managing its fiscal affairs and how T20 is going to react to these kind of postulations by the Prime Minister after making such statements in the Parliament? How do you see the investors reading these kind of remarks made by the Prime Minister yesterday in the Parliament?
Yeah, I think the Prime Minister was right to highlight these things. I think just to give a little more context to, you know, your viewers, right? 1MD will be, you know, has been an issue for our country for the last 7-8 years in terms of the market view or the global market view on Malaysia. We're coming to the tail end of it. What I mean by that is, you know, a large majority of the 1MDB debt has been, repaid or settled, and with a little bit to go. The big payment was kind of early this year. We have probably about 9 or 10 billion left versus kind of like a $40-50 billion hole, right? And that should allow us a little bit more fiscal space. It has been very fiscally constraining the last kind of 3 years or so in terms of having to repay that debt and considering it as development expenses without actually having any development done because it was all for past transgressions, right? But going forward, you know, that going away or that not being in the rear view mirror should give a little bit more fiscal space to the government. And it shows in the budget, right? They're having to spend less on 1MDB repayments in the coming year, and they're forecasting a lot less in 2024 as well. So that should help, right? In terms of confidence in our fiscal position. All right. And when it comes to subsidies, it's huge. It's, you know, every year the size of 1MDB the last 3 years, right? Like 50-60 billion. I think in budget 2023 it was at 57 billion, and the government is looking to, I would say, do the low-hanging fruit first, right? So first the corporate electricity subsidies, then they're going to go with diesel, then the big one, which is, you know, RON 95, right? I think that's going to be a bit shocking, I would say, to the Malaysians as a whole, but we need to do something, and it's better than doing nothing, right? To, you know, kind of really enhance or fix our fiscal position even further and be a more responsible nation. I think the easiest way would be to kind of take the bandaid off and then provide some aid directly to those who need it most. But that's just my opinion. I think it remains to be seen what the government actually does, what mechanism they actually have to remove those subsidies.
Yeah. That's the idea right now. I mean, your view is precisely that. Your view, in fact, one would argue that current consensus right now is that there exists some form of political stability in Malaysia vis-à-vis the past few years. Also, economic policies, for better or worse, are clear. And because of the political stability and economic policies that are clear, this has made the argument that investment growth for the first quarter have led to encouraging levels. And the Prime Minister has indeed said as much yesterday in Parliament. He said that approved investments for the first quarter of this year totaled 71 0.4 billion ringgit. This is a 60% increase from the 44 billion ringgit recorded in the first quarter of last year. The Prime Minister also cited that AWS plans to invest 25 billion ringgit, 25 and a half actually, as well as investments from Tesla, for instance, in EV, China-based Rongshan Petrochemicals Limited in petrochemical products, and Geely and Proton trying to grow their business in Tanjung Malim, in their automotive city. So because of all this, the Prime Minister also said that the economic policies before were confusing, but Malaysia's economic growth would not have outpaced those of, say, Indonesia, Vietnam and China, the markets that we always talk about that tends to outdo Malaysia. Malaysia's economy grew by 5.6% for the first quarter of this year. The better-than performance, such as countries like Indonesia, China and Vietnam, is indeed quite promising for the first quarter. But if you look at the longer term, maybe the past 10 quarters, Malaysia still is lacking behind. This growth is also stronger than Menegara's forecast, between 4.0 to 5.0 for this year. So because of this, do you feel that there's some encouraging signs for Malaysia when it comes to growing the economy for this year? And then, of course, the tack-on question is it are you fearful or are you a little bit more pessimistic because this strong growth might lead to unwanted side effects like inflation and many others? How do you see Malaysia's growth in the next few quarters, and what does it mean for folks like you and me at the retail level?
That's a lot in there. I think where I see things headed, the number one word to use is moderation, and the number two word that I want to use is global impact, right? So moderation meaning, you know, we had a very, very shocking 2020-21 due to COVID, right? And we had a huge recovery in 2022 due to a low base effect. We're starting to see that moderate now, right? And we're going to see further moderation in Q2 and Q3. Why do I say that? Because last year we had, you know, a big lift up, not just of the recovery, but indirect fiscal stimulus due to, you know, EPF withdrawals in April and May last year, which we're not going to have this year, one thinks. And that was an impact that lasted several months, right, from Q2 and into Q3. So you're going to see that moderate, right? You're going to see a lower level of growth, particularly on the services or the wholesale and retail trade side, which is going to push GDP growth down, certainly below Q1 levels. I don't think we're going to see 5.6 the next couple of quarters. So that's one thing to note. But more importantly, or equally importantly, is how the global economy is doing, right? Exports dropping to China and US dropping by 20% year on year is large, right? And these are our key markets in terms of, you know, importing and exporting trade of electronics, which is a big sector for us, chemicals, huge sector for us, all these sectors are down year on year. So that's going to be what I say just now, global impact, right? So the first thing to note for folks looking at GDP, you're going to see it moderate, mainly due to the huge base effect from last year. But second, we're going to have to watch for kind of global deterioration in demand, right, for our products, right? And if those continue to deteriorate, I won't say there's nothing that we can do, right? The government needs to put in policies that kind of shield us from these things. And if it looks like they're doing it, and they just need to continue doing it and continue being consistent with attracting high quality investments. You mentioned Tesla, you mentioned Amazon, right? These should be designed to be high quality investments, which gives us a small solid footing to withstand all these pressures, right? So that's what I think.
There's also the execution risk, actually, Han, because while we tend to succeed very well at that in terms of making these landmark decisions or flagship decisions and announcements, the follow-through work might not necessarily translate in the initial idea of how much investments are going to come in. How worried are you when it comes to execution risk, particularly from the rank and file, from the regulatory aspect and many more? In fact, I just met one nice individual from the UK, and he was talking about how setting up a business in Malaysia, especially for a Brit, is not necessarily as easy as he thought. So he was comparing it against the UK businesses and how it's quite fairly easy for a foreigner to set up business in the UK. That's just one pedestrian view, I suppose. But generally speaking, I've kind of heard these kind of views again and again. So how worried are you when it comes to execution risk in trying to realise these kind of investments and growth for the country?
I think Malaysians, we read the headline numbers, right? Which is, you know, amazing amount, you know, 150 billion, 170 billion approved investments. And then there's announcement of who's been investing, who's doing the investing. But I think if you look at the track record of approved, actually realized investments, it's somewhere in the region of kind of 25 to 40% of the announced number, right? I don't want to say specifically which administration did what percent. That's not the focus. The focus is you don't always get your entire approved investments due to various things, which is not just Malaysia things. I mean, it could be a change of direction at the company after a couple of years, that kind of thing. So you typically see somewhere between a quarter to a half of those approved investments actually materialize. I think the onus is on folks like Maida, folks like Miti, to not handhold, but to ensure that those guys who, you know, we spend so much effort to coax or to persuade or to convince to invest in Malaysia actually do so, follow up with them on a regular basis, do what you do best, right? And for me, it's a case of making sure that we are seen as a place of stability, safety in a kind of a very tense geopolitical situation globally, where, you know, we position ourselves as neutral, open for business. And, you know, to be fair to us, you know, Malaysia was ranked, you know, I think top 15, I think it was 12th on the list of, you know, global easiest places to do business. It is easy to set up a company here. Might not be so easy to do certain businesses here due to certain regulations. But in terms of setting a company, it's pretty easy to do so. In terms of setting, a general business, it's easy to do so. Perhaps certain business lines have a little bit more red tape than others.
Okay, let's now tap into your particular skill of being the certified financial planner that you are. Allure for investors to start taking up risky investments is there. In fact, some of my friends are asking me about investing in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. They're thinking about trying to invest in a very short but actually highly lucrative kind of type of investments. Maybe you can share with us the age-old view of how we should invest, particularly at a time when we are seeing debt rising faster than income. What would be some of the ideas that you have right now, particularly when it comes to folks, regular Malaysians, that might not necessarily have the kind of disposable income today as they had before?
Yeah, I think the age-old question around risk versus return comes to play, right? You mentioned a few things there, right? I'll split it up into a few things. Number one, if you hear about an opportunity which sounds too good to be true, it probably is, right? Something that tells you guaranteed return, it's a high risk, but high return, but don't worry, it's guaranteed. That doesn't sound like a genuine investment to me. It's kind of good, too good to be true. With Bitcoin, alternative assets, specifically cryptocurrencies, and Bitcoin and Ethereum and things like that, they are what they are, right? They are high risk investments, high volatility. But very importantly to an investor, and as an investment advisor, I say this all the time, high volatility can be your friend, right? Especially if it's an asset class which is not very correlated to other asset classes. For example, like price of Bitcoin or Ethereum is generally not correlated to anything. It's really its own asset class. And that has a purpose. That can have a purpose in a portfolio, right? But beware of that high volatility, moderate it within your portfolio, keep it as a very small percentage of your portfolio, just as a topping up or allowing you to top up those returns without taking on too much risk, right? Just beware of the volatility. It's become a mainstream asset class. Use regulated platforms. Be careful of folks telling you to invest. Hey, invest in my thing over here. It's unregulated. It's unlicensed. Use licensed platforms by the SC to invest in these things. And beware of the volatility. Make sure it's nice and measured within your portfolio.
What about gold prices? I've seen gold prices fluctuating, rebounding quite dramatically ahead of the FOMC. Some people are thinking about gold as an investment to hedge off other types of assets right now. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I think the one thing about gold and one thing that's missed in the gold narrative is that over the last decade or so, and it has accelerated the last 24 months, is central banks globally buying gold, right? And you've got to ask yourself, why are they doing this, right? Why are they buying gold in large and large amounts? I'm talking tons and tons of gold, literal tons. And part of the reason is, number one, a little fear on US monetary and fiscal policy. So that's one, right? If something bad happens with the US dollar, I need a hedge, right? And gold is a pretty good hedge against that. But the other part is also around sovereignty, right? If I have the gold, I have the value sitting in my vault and not in somebody else's currency. I think that's kind of another big thing. So that is your play for also an investor, right? Now, gold, just like Bitcoin, does not have any specific economic value beyond that, right? It's still useful, but just keep in mind that, you know, it's more of a hedge, it's more of an insurance policy. And then the question is, what are you insuring against? You're insuring against a couple of things. Number one, any risk to the US dollar, right? In terms of monetary debasement, in terms of exporting their inflation, in terms of failure of the currency, you know, I'm not allowed to say that kind of thing, but failure of the currency of the US dollar, you have something like gold and or Bitcoin, which are not necessarily correlated to those things. They're not under the control of anyone. So that's useful stuff. But, you know, you won't put your whole portfolio into an insurance contract, right? You put a little bit just to make sure you're well insured, right? And then you remain with the rest of your portfolio, equities, bonds, right? So you have equities, bonds, a little bit of gold, a little bit of Bitcoin. You know, that feels like a nice balanced portfolio.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Han, for speaking with us this morning. That was Han Liu, the co-founder and director of Ringgit Plus. There are some developments domestically as well in terms of political news. The parliament is going to be going on for the next few days ahead of us. And of course, part of the agenda is trying to clear out some of the bills that the MPs have indeed been presenting and waiting for the parliament to approve. One such key approval was the decriminalisation of suicide. Another one is on the Improvement of Mental Health Act. So these are the kind of laws that many observers outside of the political spectrum as well as outside of the business circles are actually thinking about and looking at. So do stay tuned with Ezra Awani in terms of how we are going to cover the proceedings of the parliament in the next few days. But for now, my name is Ibrahim Sani. Have a great one ahead of you.